following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
We're dealing with today what is a very important period of Jewish history, especially because it's related to the holiday we're going to have in a couple weeks, which is Hanukkah. Okay, and I'll give you some historical background, which will definitely... We'll definitely give you a better perspective when we get to the holiday itself. Now, we talked yesterday about the Greeks, a little bit about Greeks in general, and Alexander the Great and all those great battles, which I'm sure you're all going to check up now because you're all going to be fascinated with military history and Greek phalanx and everything. Let's now zoom in Jewish history. We're talking about the year about 331 BCE, which is when Alexander the Great, in the middle of his campaigning, he's already fought a couple of those really big battles. The Persians are on the retreat. He takes a break from campaigning in the east and comes west. And it's a very interesting description in the Gemara in Yuma in 69a, if you want to look up in your art scroll Gemara. Interesting story about Alexander the Great coming to Jerusalem. Alexander the Great was told the Samaritans, remember those not-so-good Samaritans in the north who are still around at this time, always making trouble, told Alexander the Great, you got these subjects, potential subjects, they're the Jews, they have this temple. If you allow them to have their temple, they're not going to be loyal subjects, you better go destroy it. So Alexander the Great, believing them, marches on Jerusalem. Now, who's leading the Jewish community at the time? It's a man by the name of Shimon HaTzadik. Okay, Shimon HaTzadik is the last of the men of the Great Assembly. Okay, and he's also the high priest. It's a fascinating story described here in Yuma, where he goes out to meet Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great gets off his horse and bows to him in the story, which is interesting. Why is Alexander the Great? And by the way, he's great for two reasons. He's one of the great, if not the greatest, military genius of all time. And he's also got a great ego. He doesn't bow to anyone. So the question is, his generals ask him, why are you bowing to this funny-looking Jewish guy with all this interesting costume on? And Alexander the Great says, you know, every night before I go into battle, I have a dream, and he never lost a battle. And I see before me the man of my dreams. Now, you got to watch out with those Greeks. They get their reputation in the ancient world quite deservedly. No, seriously. It's a serious thing if you study, not just the Greeks. That's not a topic for this class, but go look at the World Perfect Seminar. I got a lot of good information on that. Yes, sir.
To know if that event is recorded.
No, it's not recorded in the Greek chronology anywhere. No, it's a Jewish story. You could take it or you can leave it. There's no reason to doubt it being correct or to make it up. But we do know, the reason why I say not to doubt it is because, first of all, it's in the Talmud, and it's not one of those stories, it's one of these fantasy stories. And also because we see the initial interaction is actually quite positive. So this seems to be that what's going on in the initial relationship would support such an event taking place. No, seriously, Alexander the Great says, this guy's clearly a good omen. It's a good omen. I see him before battle, and I never lose a battle. It must be good. So he has, and then, of course, what does Alexander do? The Jews plead their case and say, we're not your enemy. The Samaritans are. And the Jews are then given free rein to go trash the Samaritans, which we promptly go and do. Of course, they never leave us alone. They're going to constantly be harassing us. But Alexander the Great has the notoriety of being one of the few people in the history of the Jewish people to peacefully absorb Israel and Jerusalem into his empire. As a tribute to that, by the way, the rabbis of that generation decreed that the firstborn sons should be named Alexander. Okay, till today, Alexander's a Jewish name. So if you don't like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you want to give your kid a cool Jewish name, call him Alex, right? We have an Alex here, Alexander here. So, the name, by the way, in yeshiva world is generally called Sender. Okay, so anyone named Sender this or Sender that, it's short for Alexander. This begins one of the most interesting interactions and most telling interactions in Jewish history. It's so central to all the future interactions of Jews and the Western world, is the relationship between Greeks and Jews. Now, I would say it's one of the most ambivalent, mixed relationships you'll see in the history of Jewish interaction with any other people. On one hand, there's a lot of positive. First of all, Alexander the Great. Anyone know who his tutor was? He had a tutor for 4 years, Aristotle, okay? They don't make tutors like that. He was clearly a man of culture and education besides a great military leader. He definitely appreciated wisdom. When the Greeks, who had conquered the entire known world, come and meet the Jews, it's a real eye-opener for them. They never met any people like this. First of all, the only monotheists in the world. We believe in a worldview that is totally different from anyone else's, right? One invisible God. Okay, that they found, by the way, pretty incomprehensible. They also had an ancient book, a tremendous obsession with knowledge and wisdom and literacy and law and understanding the world and a universal vision and you name it. These were things the Greeks had never come across, the people like this. Intellectual and spiritual like the Jews didn't exist anywhere else in the world at the time. Okay, and the Jews also, looking at the Greeks, they had a similar feeling. Here's a people, very different from anyone we've interacted with before, speaking a totally different language. A language which, by the way, gets a huge amount of praise in the Talmud. It says Greek is the most beautiful language in the world. It's the language you can write. It's the only language you can write a Torah scroll in. That's going to be kosher outside of Hebrew. But again, it also says very bad things about the Greeks. So there's a very interesting relationship going on here between the Greeks and between the Jews. By the way, the Greeks are the first people to translate. I believe it is Ptolemy the Third in the 3rd century. I'm not sure, I have to check which Ptolemy it is. He does what's called Targum Shivim, as we say in Aramaic, the translation of the 70, the Septuagint. He takes 70 rabbis and locks them in 70 different rooms and asks them to translate the Torah into Greek. And miraculously, they all make the same translation because there are parts of the Torah that are ambiguous. They didn't want the Greeks to read anything into it that wasn't kosher. That's considered a national disaster day for the Jewish people, because ever since the non-Jewish world got a hold of our Bible, they've been giving us trouble ever since. But it does say a lot about the Greeks as being interested enough in Judaism to want to have a version in their own vernacular. And by the way, Greece is going to become, along with Aramaic, Greek is going to, along with Greek culture spreading throughout the world, becoming the world culture. The Greek language is going to become, along with Aramaic, and often replacing it as the intellectual language of the world, the lingua franca of the ancient world. And many Jews are going to see their first languages are going to be Aramaic and Greek. Jews will always know Hebrew, but will often not be the spoken language. It'll be the language of prayer and of study. Okay, it'll be like the international language of the Jews, but not necessarily like American Jews today. You might know Hebrew on the side. Chances are you don't. But the language you speak on the street is American English. Okay, now... After Alexander dies, okay, and he dies in about 323. Again, the exact dates we don't know for sure. Most historians say around 323, at age probably about 32. Dies very young. Again, having campaigned for more than a decade, his men eventually basically give up on him. They say, enough already. We want to go home. You know, he's been here for a long time. There's problems at home too. He's not around to take care of things. Alexander the Great never makes it home. He, after dismantling the Persian Empire, building 6 cities by the name Alexandria. Okay, 6 cities he builds. Only one of which today survives and we know of, which is on the delta of the Nile up there by the Mediterranean, Alexandrian Egypt, which, by the way, for centuries is going to be the cultural intellectual center of the world. There is nothing equivalent to Alexandria in the world today in terms of such a high concentration of culture and you name it. And, of course, the population of Alexandria 2,000 years ago is going to be a third Jewish. Unbelievable. Probably the largest Jewish population in the world, larger than Jerusalem, is going to be in Alexandria in Egypt. The largest synagogue in the world is going to be built there. It's a synagogue that is so large that when they give you an aliyah to go up to read the Torah, the gabbai had to wave a flag so you could see in the back to answer, you know, to Borchu. Huge, gigantic Jewish community. So interesting. This is one of the cultural legacies of the Greeks in Alexander. He dies of some exotic disease over there in the Persian Empire. Judging from his lifestyle, I'm not at all surprised that he died of exotic diseases. You know, people getting similar diseases today, we don't know what he died of. But he dies and his empire falls apart. The Greeks are only unified for a very short period of time. Okay, when his empire falls apart, it's split into 3 empires. There's a Greek empire in Greece, which is led by one of Alexander's generals by the name of Antigonus. There's a Greek empire in Egypt, which is going to be led by one of Alexander's generals called Ptolemy, with a P first, P-T, Ptolemy, right? Ptolemy. Those are going to be called the Ptolemies, the Ptolemaic Greek Empire. And there's going to be a third Greek empire in the east, based in the area of Assyria, okay, this part of the world, the Arabian area, and the former Persian Empire. Those are going to be called, it's going to be led by the Greek general Seleucid. They're going to be called the Seleucids. Okay, so we have Greece, Ptolemies, Seleucids. Greece is not going to be important for us so much. And by the 2nd century before the Common Era, Rome, which is already a rising world power, is going to already absorb Greece into its empire. So the first Greek empire that's going to cease to exist is going to be in Greece itself. It's going to become part of the Roman Empire. then the Romans are going to swallow up the other two empires. But what concerns us is going to be the Greek empires in both Egypt and in Syria, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, because that is where we're going to get stuck between. Now, initially, the Jewish people are going to be under the control of the Ptolemies in Egypt, who are a little more liberal. Alexandria being a great cultural center, you know, a little more liberal and open-minded. So it's a little bit easier for the Jews. In 198, after the Battle of Panias, which is up north in Israel, Antiochus III is going to get control. Antiochus is the king of the Seleucid, the Assyrian Greeks. He wrestles control of Israel from the Ptolemies. And from that period of time on, from 198 until the Maccabean Revolt, it's going to be under the control of the Assyrian Greek Empire. Let's just stop for a minute before we go further in the history and talk a little about what's going on in the land of Israel in terms of the transmission process. This is very significant. I mentioned previously that in the First Temple period, there are no heresies, right? No one can deny the oral laws given by God. You had a question. You could go to a prophet or the high priest, and he had his Urim V'Thummim, his breastplate. You have a strong, unified Torah authority. Second Temple period, we're going to see that things start to fray at the edges because we no longer have prophecy and because we no longer have strong central authority, and the power of the Sanhedrin is not what it used to be, etc. It's going to have a big impact on the transmission process. After Shimon HaTzadik, the guy who meets Alexander, the next main character in the story is a guy by the name of Antigonus Ish Socho. Now, Antigonus, if you read the Ethics of the Fathers, it mentions Shimon HaTzadik and it mentions Antigonus. Antigonus is the next, he's sort of the intermediary figure between the end of the Great Assembly and the beginning of what we're going to call the Zugot. We'll talk about the Zugot in a minute. The five pairs of Torah scholars who are going to lead the Sanhedrin. He's the transitional guy. Antigonus, very significant character, but I want to look at two of his students because they are going to do something that has huge impact on Jewish history. They're going to set a pattern that's going to be repeated over and over again. He has two students named Tzaduk and Botus. Okay, Tzaduk and Botus are students of his who are obviously big scholars who go off. They go off the derech, as we like to say in yeshiva language. They get a couple of ideas in their head that aren't kosher, probably from the Hellenistic world. And they split away from mainstream Judaism. They become heretical students. And because of this period of time, because this is the period of time when you could challenge the validity of basic tenets of Judaism. Second Temple period, you can start doing this. And from then on, people are going to do it all the time. They're going to create two groups of followers called Baisumim, the followers of Boethius, Baitumim, and also, sorry? His name is spelled like Boethus, something like that, Botus. And Tzaduk, like Zadok. Tzaduk's followers are going to be called the Tzadukim. Okay, that's Tzadukim, by assuming more or less, philosophically speaking, more or less the same thing. What are they going to go after? And this is a very important thing to keep in mind. It's a tremendous pattern for heresies and splinter groups in Jewish history. They're going to attack not the oral Torah, the written Torah, because you can't attack the written Torah. What do you mean? It's right there in front of you. They're going to attack the oral Torah. What do I mean by attacking it? They're not going to sit there and beat up a copy of the Mishnah. It doesn't exist yet. They're going to say the oral Torah is made up by the rabbis. And it's just rabbinic Judaism, as we call it. This is something made up by a power group within the Jewish people. Attacking the oral Torah is attacking the essence of what Judaism is all about. The whole transmission process is based on the successful, accurate transmission of the 613 commandments and the principles of how to apply them from Moses at Mount Sinai all the way through Jewish history. What makes us Jews is not the written Torah. Already by this period of time, the Greeks have their own version of it, the Septuagint. Okay? What makes us Jews is the oral Torah. The survival of the Jewish people has been based on the survival of that body of information. That is what is always going to be attacked. The make it or break it issue between mainstream Judaism, when I say mainstream, I mean orthodox, which is a word I hate to use. We're going to see orthodox as a term created by the reform movement in Germany in the 19th century to make traditional Jews look backward and close-minded. But when I talk about mainstream Torah observant Jews, the make it or break it issue is always going to be, do you recognize the validity of the oral Torah as being given by God at Mount Sinai and the authority and ability of the rabbis to transmit that and interpret it and apply it? Period. All major schisms in Jewish history are going to be attacking that. We're going to see it with the Tzadukim. We're going to see it in the 9th century with the Karaites, the Karoyim in Babylon. We're going to see it with the conservative movement in America in the late 19th century. I would say not with reform, because reform dumps everything. We're going to see. Again, I mean, I don't get into reform and conservative now, but that's going to be the make it or break it issue. We have to keep that in mind. It's such an important point. You had a question? Any question? Okay, so these, the Tzedukim, by the way, as a group, now I want to read you a little. Now, to digress for 1 minute and tell you about a character who is indispensable to understanding this period of time in Jewish history. Anyone, I repeat, anyone who's even a remotely serious scholar of Jewish history, even if you're not, you just want to have a good library, you have to invest in one book, which is the single greatest book of Jewish history ever written, the collected works of Flavius Josephus. Okay, Josephus, who is a Jew who lives in Israel during the first century, who lived through the great revolt against Rome, which led to the destruction of the Second Temple. Hold on. Very unusual character in Jewish history. On one hand, he's a Kohen, he's a loyal Jew. On the other hand, he will surrender to the Romans during the Great Revolt and become adopted by the Roman family, be used as the Romans as a translator, by the Romans as a translator, and also be the official, one of the official chroniclers of the Great Revolt. Therefore, he wears many hats. He has a Jewish hat, a Roman hat. When you read Josephus, you have to read him very critically. Like all historians of this period of time, he has a definite, clear bias. He also tends to exaggerate when talking about numbers. He does, however, give a basic flow of historically accurate information, which is indispensable to not only archaeologists but historians in this period of time. He wrote three great works of literature, which you can get all together in one volume. You get a good volume, an annotated volume. That's fantastic. One is Contra Appian. Appian was a classical anti-Semite writing at the period of time, I believe from Alexandria in Egypt. Putting out anti-Semitic literature, Josephus writes a defense of the Jewish people, Contra Appian, against Appian. The second thing is Josephus's history of the ancient Jewish people, called Antiquities. The third is the Great Revolt, the Jewish War, his account of everything leading up to the Great Revolt and through the Great Revolt, up to the fall of Masada, and you name it. Now again, you got to read Josephus critically, but he is an indispensable supply of information on this period of time. You had a question? Well, his name is Josephus. His name is Joseph ben Matisyahu is his proper name. We call him IBM, Joseph ben Matisyahu, right? But the title he takes once he's adopted by the Roman royal family is Flavius Josephus. Okay? I want to read you what Josephus says a little bit. This is from... Here we go. This is from the Jewish Wars, chapter 2, 119 through 66. Three philosophical schools. Josephus is going to identify the different sects running around the Jewish world. He says, for there are three philosophical schools amongst the Jews. The followers of the first are the Pharisees. Now the Pharisees, once the Tzaddukim start, those people who separate themselves, the rabbis who don't follow the followers of Tzaddik, but stay with mainstream Judaism, the Perushim, they separate themselves. That's what the word means. They separate themselves out and stay along with mainstream Judaism. These are the Pharisees. And that he says, the followers of the first are the Pharisees, and the second, the Sadducees. That's the anglicized version of Tzaddukim. And the third, who pretend to a more severe discipline, are called the Essenes. Of the two first named schools, the Pharisees are those who are considered most skillful in the exact explication of their laws, and are the leading school. They ascribe all to fate and to God, and yet allow that to do what is right, or to the contrary, is principally the power of men, although fate does cooperate in every action. They say that all souls are imperishable, but that the soul of good men only pass into other bodies, while the souls of evil men are subject to eternal punishment. But the Sadducees are those that compose the second order and exclude fate entirely, and suppose that God is not concerned with our doing or not doing with what is evil. They say that to do what is good or what is evil is men's own choice, and that the choice of one or the other belongs to each person, who may act as he pleases. They also exclude the belief in immortality of the soul and the punishment and rewards of the afterworld. Moreover, the Pharisees are friendly to one another and cultivate harmonious relations with the community, but the behavior of the Sadducees towards one another is to some degree boorish, and their conversation with those that are of their own party is barbarous, as if they were strangers to them. And this is what I have to say concerning the philosophical schools amongst the Jews, and so on. Not the easiest thing to read, very wordy. But he basically says, in a nutshell, the Tzaddukim are going to be a much smaller sect of the Jewish people. They are the splinter sect. Mainstream Judaism follows the Pharisees. That's going to be the vast majority of the Jews at this period of time. The Tzaddukim split off. They're basic, and you can see they're very clearly influenced by Greco-Roman thought. The idea, an idea that bothered the Greeks tremendously, was not one God, although they were polytheists, wasn't such a hard idea for them to understand. An infinite being who is perfect, to bother, for that being to waste his time on the physical world and imperfect human beings, it's denigrating for God to do such a thing. This is very much an idea you see in the Tzaddukim. They deny the validity of the oral law. They're not secular Jews, by the way. They keep to strict interpretation of the written law. Many of them are priests, Kohanim, who are deliberately going to do the wrong thing in the temple because they don't have the oral law to tell them what to do. They deliberately do the opposite. There's all kinds of stories. A great story of during Sukkot when the high priest is supposed to pour the wine and water into these holes on the altar in a special way. He pours it out on the Mizbeach, on the altar, deliberately doing the wrong thing without the oral tradition. And it says that all the Jews throw their esrogim at him. They pelted him with esrogim. He's a Tzaddukhi high priest. This is reflected over and over again. It says, if you read in the Mishnah on Yom Kippur, it says the night before the Yom Kippur service, the rabbis would come and expound to the high priest. They'd say, Ishi Kohen Gadol, you got to promise you're going to do the right thing. And then it says, and he would turn away and cry, and they would turn away and cry. And why are they telling him he's got to do the right thing? And Yom Kippur is a heavy thing. Why? Because many of the high priests were Tzaddukim who would do the wrong thing. They'd walk into the Holy of Holies and do the wrong service with the incense. Deliberately do it that way. Okay, so we know it's a very big problem. The high priesthood is going to be a large extent corrupted, which is why it brings down that in the Talmud that there were so many high priests in the Second Temple period. They didn't survive to be high priests a year later. Okay, so the Tzaddukim represent the upper class. A lot of priests are involved in the Tzaddukim, whereas mainstream Judaism is going to be involved in, is going to follow the Pharisees and keep to the oral law and you name it. The Essenes that Josephus mentions, I don't want to get into now because that's a group that's going to be much more relevant when we talk about Christianity. Any questions? So we have these splinter groups. Now, just to continue with the transmission process, there's a group of rabbis we want to look at now, just for a minute, called the Zugot. The Zugot run from 260 BCE till 10 BCE, 250-year period, where you're going to have two scholars who are going to act as the Av Beis Din and the Nasi. Av Beis Din meaning that the administrator of the Sanhedrin and Nasi is the president of the Sanhedrin. The word Zugot, what does it mean? The word Zug in Hebrew, you guys know what it means? Pair, exactly. It's a pair. One is the Av Beis Din, one is the Nasi. These are the two guys who run the Sanhedrin. They are very significant people in terms of their place in the transmission process of Torah. The five pairs are, you don't have to write them all down now. If you don't get them, I can tell you them later. Yossi ben Yoezer and Yossi ben Yochanan. The second is Yeshua ben Prachya and Nitai ha-Arbeli. Arbeli meaning from the Arabel, which is that cliff over the Sea of Galilee. Very important point later in Jewish history we'll talk about. Yehuda ben Tobiah and Shimon ben Shetach. A very significant character in Jewish history during the later Hasmonean period. Shmaya and Aftalion, who, by the way, are both descended from converts. Very interesting. In Judaism, it's a meritocracy. The best guys rise to the top regardless of their ancestry. Last but not least, we have the most famous pair of the Zugot, Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai are very important because they're living in a very difficult period of time. And it is after their, after their time that their students are going to bring the first halachic disagreements into Jewish law. All the disagreements we have in the Talmud come after the period of Hillel and Shammai. We'll talk about that a little bit later when we get to talk about the Mishnah and the Talmud. But those are four pairs of rabbis, the Zugot ruling. We're talking about 260 to 10 before the Common Era. Yes, sir? No, because there we're talking about Tzaddukim becomes a high priest because the high priesthood, first of all, you have to be Kohen to be high priest. Meritocracy is the real leadership of the Jewish people in the Sanhedrin. Kingship, only the house of King David. Okay? Priesthood, descendants of Aaron. In an ideal system, only a very righteous Kohen would be a priest. The problem is the Second Temple period. If you go in Josephus has a huge amount of information on the different Kohanic families, the Tobiahs, you name it. He goes through all. It's much too complicated for us to go into. He could spend literally a couple weeks going through just the discussions of what is going on in the priestly families during this period of time. They're all corrupted. We're dealing with a period of time we're going to look at now when the Romans are going to be ruling Jerusalem, the Greeks and the Romans, and they're going to do what they like, especially when we get to the Roman period of time. They're going to appoint the high priest. Kohanim are going to buy the position. We're not talking about Judaism functioning the way it should. We're being functioning in a very less than ideal situation. If you look in Pirkei Avot, the ethics of the fathers, all these guys are in there. Yeshua ben Prachi and Nitai Arbali, they're all in there. Very interesting. If you read it now, you'll understand where they fit in. Okay, I want to get to the Maccabean Revolt. We've been talking about the transmission process. Let's go back to the Greeks. Remember, Greek Empire is now split. Israel has the misfortune, just as in the First Temple period, we are stuck between the great world empires of Egypt and Assyria and constantly being the site of major battles and constantly switching sides and being torn in between these two great world powers. We are now going to find ourselves, unfortunately, pulled into a much larger power structure between the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria, and also find ourselves in a very difficult internal situation of schism within the Jewish people, in which the Greeks are going to ally themselves with certain parties in the Jewish people, and it's going to lead to the first ideological religious war in human history. Now remember, during this period of time, we said from 198 onward, Israel is under the control of the Assyrian Seleucid Greeks. During the reign of Antiochus IV, which is 175 to 164, the situation is going to get very bad for the Jewish people. Antiochus IV, who's actually doing quite well against his Ptolemaic enemy Greek empire, but he's also having a problem with the Romans. He's under a lot of pressure now, a lot of pressure. He's very threatened by both the Egyptian Greeks and the Romans, who are rapidly becoming a huge world empire. He realizes that the weak link in his defenses are the Jews, being that they border Egypt and they also run the Mediterranean, and they're also not into Greek culture. And he's going to now move on the Jewish people in a way that is going to be very significant and quite unique till that time in human history. But just before we get to that, by the way, just talk about, to go back to one more thing, we're talking about the priesthood. The priesthood is going to be corrupted during this period of time. One of the first steps that Antiochus IV is going to do to pacify the Jews and get them more into Greek culture is go after the high priesthood, realizing that's the holiest office in the Jewish people. He takes the high priest, whose name is Chonio, who also has the name Onias III. They all had even Greek names at the time. He's going to displace him and put in his place a guy by the name of Jason, who is his Hellenized brother. Jason is a Tzaduki, a Hellenized guy. He's not into mainstream Judaism. He's not loyal. Chonio, who is disgruntled, is going to go to Alexandria, is going to build outside Alexandria in a place called Heliopolis an exact replica of the temple and do his own temple sacrifice there. Something which is, by the way, not allowed to be done. But it's interesting, you have a mini, it's like going to Brooklyn and building a base of Migdash there, you know? We're not talking about a pagan shrine, a Jewish shrine identical in many respects with the same service going on. From Kohanim, who didn't like what was going on by the Greeks in Jerusalem, they're going to go there. Later on, by the way, they're going to even put non-Kohanim into the office of high priest. That's how bad it's going to get. From this period of time onward, the whole high priesthood is going to be corrupted, more or less. It's going to become an institution that is going to not be a kosher institution in the Jewish world. So what we're seeing here is the pattern of what's going to evolve through later Jewish history of all the basic institutions being lost. Kingship and monarchy, priesthood is going to be gone, temple service is going to be corrupted, it's going to be even done wrong. What's going to be left are the rabbis, okay, the Pharisees, which is the next group of rabbis that are going to come in now. Antiochus then does something that's unprecedented in the history of the ancient world. He moves against Judaism with the backing of a minority population of the Jewish people. It's very important to understand that the Hanukkah story is as much a civil war as it is a war against Greece. And it's not a war for national liberation. It is not a struggle for physical freedom. It is a struggle of ideas. That's why it is such an interesting conflict in Jewish history, because it's so unique and because it is symbolic of a much greater struggle in human history. What's the struggle of ideas? It's between the Greek worldview and the Jewish worldview. And before we get to the actual history, let's look a little bit into what is certainly one of the most fascinating topics in Jewish history. What's the struggle over? We already talked about, on one hand, right, that the Greeks and the Jews are very attracted to each other because they're intellectual cultures with philosophical traditions, and, you know, and the Greeks also had a very unusual component the Jews didn't have. The Greeks were really into the physical world. Really into the physical world. All the classical art and architecture we have is the glorification and perfection of physical forms. You look at Greek building, those clean lines, the columns, the facades, you name it. This is the Greek way. The way they organize cities, neat, clean, that's the Greeks. Also in their culture, the perfection of the physical form. The Greeks were totally into all this obsession we have with the body today. It comes from the Greeks. It's such a Greek thing. You know, where do the Greeks practice their culture? The Romans are going to imitate the Greeks also in this respect, in gymnasiums. Gymnasium, by the way, comes from the Greek word gymnos, which means naked, because the human form was the ultimate expression of beauty. You ever look at the art? Look at sculpture in Greece. Everyone's perfect. Everyone. All the guys have these rippling, you know, biceps, and you know they have pectorals. Everyone looks great. They're throwing discuses. Everyone looks fantastic. The only difference, by the way, if you look at like women as portrayed in Greek art, they're all a little heavier. Because in the ancient world, I say, I love my favorite comment in the ancient, you know, in the ancient world, to have some meat on your bones was a sign that you were eating and therefore wealthy and healthy. Only in the modern world do we think it is sexy to look like you are coming from the third world and dying of starvation. But the obsession with perfection of the physical is a Greek idea. You know, the Olympics, sporting events, the body, this is it. The Greeks, despite all their philosophy, and they were very profound thinkers in understanding the world, the Greeks were ultimately obsessed with understanding the physical world. The Greeks introduced into human consciousness an idea which is going to be come into play as one of the most powerful intellectual forces in modern history, humanism. The human being is the center of all things. The human mind and its ability to understand and observe and comprehend things rationally. That's an idea which comes from the Greeks. That's an idea which is going to be lost to the Western world for hundreds of years and then rediscovered in the Renaissance and take on a totally new life in the Age of Enlightenment. That's the great Greek idea. Glorification. Physical, the whole concept, their concept of modesty. I mean, running around naked was considered a normal thing in Greece. Public toilet in Greece was a bench on Main Street with holes in it. You sat there and did your business as people walked by. Okay, completely different idea. Completely different. The Greeks, as I mentioned before, also could not comprehend the notion of, not that they have one God. They were polytheists for sure, but the Greeks weren't so firm as we say. The Greeks are hardly the most religious. Look at ancient Egypt. They were really into idolatry. The Greeks were into the human being. All Greek gods look like people. They're all anthropomorphized, you know, to the Greek gods. Jewish gods, Judaism, it's interesting, a great contrast. Human beings are made in the image of God. Greek theology is that gods are made in the image of human beings with all the faults and foibles. Read Greek mythology. The gods, they eat, they sleep around, just like people. Okay, very, very different worldview. What really bothered the Greeks on a philosophical level, they were obsessed with perfection. An absolute, invisible, perfect God, not a problem for the Greeks even. But that perfection should deal with change and imperfection and deal with piddly human beings? That's an idea that is flawed. Okay? Judaism teaches the exact other. Judaism are not, we're not otherworldly here. We're not like Buddhist monks. But Judaism teaches, the Greeks were, physical world is the end of it all. Judaism is the physical world is not something to be denied, but to be elevated into spirituality. To sum it up beautifully, as Dennis Prager says so nicely, to the Greeks, what was beautiful was holy. To the Jews, what was holy was beautiful. The Greeks represent external, an obsession with the external. In many ways, the superficial, although they were not superficial people. Western civilization is a mere skeleton today of what the Greeks were. They're much bigger thinkers than we are today. So to the Greeks, what was beautiful was holy. To the Jews, what was holy is beautiful. And by the way, so you want to look very interesting. In Hebrew, the word for Greek, look on the top, is Yud Vav Nun. Yavan. How's that for a really cool looking word? The three letters of the Hebrew alphabet, which as you write them, are completely external letters. They have no internalness. Like when I say internalness, you see that's in the letter of the bay to the aleph. There's bits inside, you know, there's nothing, just lines. Yud, vav, nun. That is what Greece is all about. Yavan, the external, the physical world, the glorification of the physical world, the obsession with the physical world, categorizing the physical world, understanding the physical world, human beings being in the center of this physical world. Turn Yavan backwards. What word do you get? Nun, vav, yud. Which is what? Is which? No, that's spelled differently. Noi. Noi is the Hebrew word for beauty. Okay, that's interesting. Greek backwards is beauty. That's the Greeks. What is beautiful is holy. There's an essential conflict in worldview. What is going to dominate? The spiritual or the physical? The spiritual or the physical? This is the great conflict intellectually behind the great battle that's going to take place through all the rest of human history between the Jews and Western civilization. What are you going to glorify? What is important? What is the center? What is the focus? What's a means to an end? What's an end to a means? To the Greek, spirituality was not the ends. It was a means to an end. To the Jews, the physical world is a means to get to spirituality. That's what you elevate. That's the ideal. Okay, very different idea. If you want to see, by the way, great stuff on this, Rabbi Matthias Weinberg, our Rosh Hashiva's nephew, who wrote a whole book on Hanukkah. He has a couple of books out in a series which he never finished called Patterns in Time. He goes through an unbelievable, interesting amount of information on Yavan, Greece, its relationship. There's a lot so close yet so far from the Jewish people. Any questions on this so far? So what are the Greeks going to attack? Since Greece, the conflict here is an intellectual, ideological conflict, not a physical conflict, the Greeks don't attack the Jews. The Greeks attack Judaism. And they wouldn't have been able to do it without the help of a certain splinter sect of the Jewish people. The Hellenized Jews, and there were definitely Jews who were sucked into Greek culture. There are definitely Jews sucked into Greek culture. Greek culture was the major cultural milieu of the ancient world. We always see this. It's a great pattern for Jewish history. A world culture comes along which is enlightened and progressive and is changing the world. And some of the upper-class Greeks, these upper-class Jews, excuse me, of course, will always get into this verse because they're rich, they're wealthy, they're free, they have a lot of spare time. They say to the Jewish people, let's get with the program. Forget this Jewish stuff. And you're going to have a small but very vocal and powerful group of Jews because they're aligned with the Greek authorities who are going to go all the way and become Hellenized. And they're going to do everything the Greeks do. I'm going to send my kid to the gymnasium. You could even have an operation that was done to have your circumcision closed up again. Because the Greeks viewed circumcision as mutilation of the body. Why would you touch the human body, which is so perfect? Can you imagine having it closed up again? Ouch. Then you have the Tzedukim there. It's a real mess. And these Hellenized Jews, and this is a great lesson and a pattern for Jewish history, our biggest enemies will often come from within our own people. These Hellenized Jews are going to, with the help of the Greek authorities, go after Judaism spiritually. They're not going to decree that all the Jews who keep Torah are going to be physically executed. They're going to decree that Jews are not allowed to keep Torah. This is a unique event in human history. No one in the ancient world declared war on other people's religions. Polytheism, as immoral as it may have been in the ancient world, was very pluralistic and open. I worship your gods, you worship mine, we trade them like baseball cards. Which is why all the Greek gods, Zeus will become Jupiter. Because all the Greek gods will just change their names and become Roman gods. And why people have thousands of gods. Because anyone the Greeks conquered, they took their gods. The Romans will have tens of thousands of gods. Because they conquered so many peoples. Pluralism. Who cares? No one dies for religion. It is a uniquely Jewish trait. It's a mirror of Abraham's strength. The Jewish people saying that there are things in this life that are worth dying for that are more meaningful than life itself. Okay, we are willing to give up our lives for Judaism. Okay, not because God needs us to die for us, but because that ideology is part of a historical mission without which humanity is doomed. That's a responsibility which we're not going to shirk. Okay, that's such an interesting story. The first ideological religious war in human history. What does Antiochus IV, also known as Epiphanes, son of God, small ego he had, what does he go after? He goes after Shabbat, the festivals, declaring of the new month, and circumcision. Okay, because Shabbat, the festivals, and New Month are destroy the Jewish calendar. We are people who are time-obsessed. Jews don't make great buildings. We don't make big temples everywhere in the world. We had one temple in Jerusalem. Jews sanctify time. Destroy time, you destroy the Jews' ability to practice Judaism. Okay, and circumcision. That's the physical, tangible sign on the human body of our relationship with God and our mission in history. It's also the thing the Greeks find most abhorrent. So together with their Jewish allies, they go after the Jewish people. And what do the Jewish people do? Most of the Jewish people, of course, staying loyal to the rabbis, are going to head to the hills. They're going to flee. Okay? And the Greeks are going to chase after them and kill Jews. Jews are going to get this very famous story of martyrdom. If you want to read, all of the accounts of what is going on are in the books of the Maccabees. The books of the Maccabees are not in the Jewish Bible. There's first Maccabees, second Maccabees. The books of the Maccabees are official court histories written during the Hasmonean dynasty, around 100 years before the Common Era. Hasmoneans are who the Maccabees will become, the royal family that's going to be come from those people who are going to lead the revolt against the Greeks. These are the official court records. They're written in Hebrew. They're not included in the Jewish Bible. It is too late in Jewish history. I'm not going to finish this whole period of time today, so when we get to the next class, when we talk about the revolt and the actual battles, etc., I'm going to read you some of the accounts of the book of the Maccabees. But the Christian world, by the way, is very into preserving the books of the Maccabees. They're in the Christian Bible because it's the idea of martyrdom and dying for beliefs. And when we get to Christianity, we'll see that the Christians are going to emulate the Jews. Because we taught the world the notion of dying for your beliefs. Today, unfortunately, has been perverted by all kinds of people into the idea that God wants me to blow myself up in a shopping mall or in a school bus. Okay, that's not a Jewish idea. But Judaism does teach that there are things you give your life for because there are things that are more important than life itself. Okay, so I'll read you some accounts of those. But basically what happens, we're going to have Jewish people heading for the hills, Greeks hunting them down, Jews found secretly practicing Torah, secretly circumcising their kids, are put to death. There's a very famous story, again, that is mentioned in the book of Maccabees of a woman who's not given a name. Later, she's given the name by the Christians, I think of Hannah and her seven sons, who all, rather than worship Greek gods, all allow themselves to be killed. It's one of the great stories of Jewish martyrdom the Christian world really gets into. The resistance is going to coalesce around one family, who I'm going to end with. I'll just introduce them now and pick them up later. It's going to coalesce around one family, a man by the name of, anyone know? Right, no, Judah Maccabee is the son. It's going to be called Mattathias. Mattathiahu ben Yochanan Cohen Gadol. Mattathias, the son of Yochanan the Cohen Gadol. He and his five sons, Yehuda, Elazar, Yochanan, Yonatan, and Shimon, who are going to be called the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, who are also going to take the name Maccabees, are going to be the family that is going to lead the revolt, that is going to throw the Greeks out of the land of Israel and reestablish Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. The most famous of all of these people is Yehuda, Judah. He takes the name Maccabees officially is more associated with him than any other person. Maccabees is an acronym for Mi Kamocha Balim Hashem, who is like you amongst the powers, O God, which is sort of the battle cry of the Jewish people. So let's stop with Judah and Maccabee and the Maccabees and the beginning of the revolt. Next class on Sunday, God willing, we'll pick up with we'll talk about what's going on in the story of Hanukkah, the Hanukkah miracle, okay, and what's going to happen after to the Maccabees themselves and the coming of the Romans.
This program is part of a series. For the continuation, please insert the next disc.